Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth, on 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and this is an extended version of Real Talk, a special, if you will. Rather than producing new half-hour shows every week, I've chosen to host occasional one-hour specials on topics of particular interest to me. I'm grateful to Voice of Vashon for allowing me this opportunity, and I hope you'll enjoy what we learn together, dear listener. In February, I plan to explore the impacts of mass incarceration from the personal perspectives of three members of the Black Prisoners Caucus. In April, I'll tackle the climate crisis from economic and uneconomic perspectives. Beyond that, curiosity will decide. This first Real Talk special for 2023 is about art. Specifically, how does an artist living on this island of artists, Vashon Island, Washington, distinguish themselves? To explore that notion with me, I am joined by three of the artists currently showing at the Vashon Center for the Arts in what is titled The Notable Collection. Welcome, Pam Ingalls.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome, Morgan Brigg.
Hello.
And welcome, Brian Fisher.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Also joining our conversation is internationally renowned cartoonist Jim Woodring, who filled the VCA Gallery in October with his whimsical and certainly distinctive works. Welcome, Jim, and thanks for planting the seed for this discussion.
Hi, Susan. Thank you.
It's so good to have all of you here. And there are so many things I want to understand about how it all works. You're all visual artists, each with a different medium. And I'd like to start by asking briefly for each of you to describe your medium. Morgan?
I am a mixed media sculptor person, and so I am using clay, I am using metal, and found objects typically. So,
and they are very whimsical.
Yeah, very figurative for the most part. Every now and again I escape that format, but for the most part it's creatures mixed with humans.
Sounds like the planet. Brian, what about your medium?
I generally describe myself as a printmaker, although that can mean many things. And for me, monotype print particularly, so one of a kind print where you're still using a plate and a press, but they come off unique. There's always discovery as part of that process. And then from those, that's actually many times the compositional element or image that I turn into paintings, and in the past some sculpture. So,
wow, pretty broad.
Sometimes, yeah.
Jim, what's your? Yeah. How do you describe your medium?
Well, I draw mostly in pen and ink, like traditional cartoonists do.
And Pam Ingalls.
Yeah, I paint with oil paints. I studied Russian Impressionist painting, so that's kind of the style I started with, and I just paint everyday things, things I find interesting, things I'm curious about, like you.
Yeah, and they are, I think, emotional. I think, probably each of you really brings a lot of emotion and feeling into your work. Each of you has a very distinctive style. So I'd like to know, when or how did you come upon this particular expression style? Jim, would you start with that?
Well, I came up with a handful of styles that I use, which I had to develop by overcoming a near complete lack of talent for drawing in order to express myself. I knew I wanted to say and draw certain things, and so I taught myself how to draw, and by the time I was in my late 20s, I was able to do that. So I had to learn how to draw in order to do what I wanted to do.
How did you learn how to draw?
Just practice, drilling, putting in hours and hours, sitting at the drawing board while my friends were out playing baseball, stuff like that, that kind of thing.
So those of us who don't have those natural gifts, you're suggesting could actually develop them.
Oh, I'm proof. I used to get sent home from schools with notes from my art teachers telling my parents they should discourage me from trying to be an artist because I had no talent. I'm not kidding. That is the truth. That's the truth.
That's hopeful for anybody out there. Pam, when and how did you fall into or discover
your particular type of expression.
I can really relate to what you were saying, Jim, because growing up, I was never any better at art than anybody else. Both my parents were artists, so I was exposed to it, but I was just kind of a flunky that way. But I had the desire, and I feel like that's what's more important, you know, that you really, really want to learn. Anyway, I studied later. I studied in college, and I studied with a Russian Impressionist later, master teacher. And then I think your style just happens. You just do what you do, and it becomes a style. And if I was trying to do a style, it probably wouldn't work.
Say more about that.
Well, I teach, too, and a lot of times I see the seed of somebody's style when they're very first starting, and then as they develop, that same seed is still there. You know, they've learned a lot about the craft, but they still have that certain thing that's their own. And I don't know. I think we can learn the craft, but the style just happens. Anyway, that's my opinion.
I think people might also ascribe that to music as well. Well, and writing. Morgan, how did you come upon the use of found objects and putting creatures and people together?
I see mine as an ongoing journey of sorts, where I started out with metal and really had to learn how to form it first. And then when I think a breakthrough for me was learning how to braze or solder the metal parts together, because that opened up a whole fabrication area where I could create bodies or whatever. And then from there, I got into clay, and then I wanted to figure out how to attach the clay, the fired clay, to metal, and then I learned enamel. Everything's self-taught, and it's just led by a curiosity. I've had I also use photo transfers, and I just thought, oh, those are so exciting with what they open up and the expression they open up. And so I figured out how to do that.
Tell us a little more about photo transfers. What exactly is that process?
It's basically a decal, but it's something that you can run through your inkjet printer, and then you give it a coating of acrylic, clear acrylic, so that you can cut out whatever part of that image you want, and then you can immerse it into water, and it basically slides off like a regular decal. And I would prepare a surface for it, which was usually enameled copper, and then I would get that enameled brazed into the position that I wanted first, and then after that I would slide the decal onto it. So,
gosh, that sounds tricky. How often does it not work? How often does it slip off in the wrong direction?
Oh, no, it always works, because it doesn't, you know, it's not a real fussy thing, as long as your surface is prepared decently. Huh. If that's not working great, then the imperfections will show through the decal, and that can be, well, that could be a plus, but usually it's not.
Sounds like it takes a lot of skill. Brian, how did you come upon printmaking? And
well,
is that where it
started? I took print classes in college. My degree is in architecture, so I kind of approach a lot of what I do with in print is like that. The process is so much part of the what it lets you do things and it doesn't let you do things, and so there's that little piece of battle that's always going on. And monotype print, particularly, is it's just a process of discovery every time. And I've gotten to the point, but because I do have this controlling nature, I usually impose the image last on all this fun that I had making the background. So lately I've been using more gold leaf as an element that defines what the piece is about. In the past, I've used line. I still do that as well. And sometimes that's the line is printed and sometimes it's painted on. So, but how I came to that, as I said, I had print classes in college and I absolutely loathed printmaking then. I didn't have enough time to get into it. And it was this thing that you had to do this before you could do that. And it seemed way too controlling. And then when I moved to Vashon, so in 89, I discovered Quartermaster Press and this thing called Monotype, where there was no intention to, you know, make 40 of an edition. And so that kind of opened up the world of print. And so I've been very happy to be on and on again, off again with that collective on Island. And I teach there. And I teach classes for my studio, too, and with Ilse Reimnitz. So, and that's always a process of discovery, too. I learn things from people all the time.
Oh, yeah. The exchange with students has got to be enlightening. Yeah. And you mentioned that you got a degree in architecture, and that makes a lot of sense when I look at your work. Anyone who knows Brian's work, it's very architectural.
Yeah. There's a quality of formality to it that fits the subject, which most of my work has its origin in a story, in myth, particularly Western myth.
Yeah. And
so there's this formality that fits, in my mind anyway, with that subject,
That kind of makes me wonder with each of you about the stories behind your works. Where do those stories come from? And are you trying to say something in particular? Jim, you particularly, because you do cartooning and cartoon strips and books, where do those stories come from?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I don't know. They, like all other ideas, they just arise.
Do you feel like you're, with each of your either cartoon strips or your books, that you're trying to say something in particular?
Oh, yes, yes. I can't proceed unless I think I'm saying something worth saying and that the whole project is worth the effort.
But so that just comes to you?
Yeah, yeah. The stories that I'm best known for, the Frank stories, do just come to me as if they were dictated. But I also do anecdotal, single, standalone drawings that I assemble like you assemble any other drawing. You get an idea, you refine it, you work out the composition, you take a couple of stabs at it, and eventually you have it. And because the things I do are somewhat, there's a lot of things in them that don't have names and are hard to identify, and what's going on is hard to identify, so I have to get everything worked out to a fare thee well in order for it to communicate so that people don't think I'm just doing a bunch of arbitrary stuff.
Well, and most of your work has no words in it, and I wonder, it makes me think that it translates internationally. Have you been published, how many other countries have you been published in?
Oh, gosh, many. Maybe 12 or 15.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Pam's going, ooh. Pam, are you telling stories with your paintings?
I don't know.
And if so, how do they come to you?
I don't know if I am or not. I think for me, story, of course they come because that's what I want to paint. So there's a story that I have. You know, I want to paint that teapot, but it might not be, or it might be the teapot I got in China or something like that. But I think the story actually comes more when the person sees the painting and then they put their own story on it. And I think that's where story comes into my work more.
Morgan, where are you on that question?
I started out as a graphic designer, and when I was being a graphic designer, I was very well aware of other people's stories, the story of their business or whatever that I was trying to convey. So I was always working on other people's stories. And then about 15 years into it, I was like, no, I want to tell my own stories. And so I made the leap into the fine art and was immediately terrified to tell my own story because I didn't want to be found out. I mean, you know, people would see who I really was, and I was terrified of that. But I think I'm still wanting to tell my own stories, but then that's kind of the place that I don't know. I mean, like what everyone else has said, it's kind of like I don't have control over it. It's just kind of, you kind of guide things, or after the fact you go, oh, I get what this is about. I mean, you know, I don't know until it's out in front of me, and then I get it. So, yeah, my intention is to tell my own stories. Now, how they come out, I have no control. So.
And
Yeah, I think there's a vulnerability to any kind of art.
Yes.
To my mind, really good art is about getting to the truth. And the truth is usually deeply inside you and very personal. Brian, with that.
Yes.
Are you telling your stories through your work, or?
Yeah, I certainly am. I always say I start with Western myth because it's something that fascinates me. And it is also, it's not just Western myth. That's kind of the, we are storytelling animals, and these are our oldest stories, and there is truth in each of those. And they, and for me, what's interesting is they're all related. I mean, whether they're culturally parallel, they're the sum of them, most of them are the same story. It's just they're told in different ways. So that's interesting to me. And out of that, certainly, these are personal stories to me for various reasons. I mean, as an adult, I look at them differently than I did as a kid. My father read Homer to me as bedtime stories. So
wow.
He was trying to put me to sleep, but, you know, this kind of defined my life.
He woke you up.
He woke me up. And... yeah. So, and I have family connections in Greece, and so that's why the Western myth, particularly, forever, it seems like, has been part of my thinking.
Do you ever get bored? Do you ever find that? Oh my gosh! There isn't another myth that I want to explore.
Good Lord, no. That's just, it goes on and on. I mean, we are, as I said, we want to make sense of the world. And this is a tradition. Myth is a tradition that it's part of our, it runs through our veins, basically, you know, so I don't get bored.
Have you ever asked people who are looking at your work what they get out of a particular image?
Yes, I think that's fascinating. Just as Morgan said, and Pam too, when people view things, they have absolutely their own sense of what it's about. It's their story. And I've had people tell me that they didn't want an explanation of what it was about because they liked it for how they saw it. And then I've had other people, actually one of my most exciting studio tours was a kid came through that was maybe 9, but right in there. And he knew as much about anything that I thought I knew about. Maybe I did at that age too, but it was amazing. But he had his own twist too on, you know, what he was seeing, but he definitely could identify what he was looking at, even in that little small range of things I had up at that point in time. But yeah, so that's very exciting to have other people look at it.
So what about the rest of you? Have you ever had surprising reactions from those people who are consuming your art? And if so, what were they? Tell me a story about a surprising reaction. Pam?
Well, a lot of times, and this is my favorite reaction, not to tell people what to do, but often someone will break into tears. And then I know I've really touched them. And sometimes, once in a while, someone will come up to me at the opening of a show and just be kind of not being able to talk because they were touched. But so that's my favorite one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jim?
Well, I've been doing this for about 30 years, and I've gotten lots and lots of reactions, especially when people wrote and sent letters. So I have boxes of letters that people have written to me telling me that my work meant something to them or got them through a hard time or made them feel they had simpatico spirits out in the world or something. So I think my work is open to interpretation, and I get a lot of different ones.
That's got to be gratifying, though. Is it stimulating to you? Have you ever had a reaction that made you want to create another story?
Well, no, but any reaction makes me feel that I'm doing what I should be doing, and so it helps me to stay with it, which I would anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, you want people to like your work and tell you they like it, of course.
Yeah, it's about communication, and communication requires a receiver. What about you, Morgan? Any surprising reactions to your work?
I've had the crying before, and that's always deeply, that's just, oh man, sucks me in. But I had this one guy another artist, and he came up to my work and up to me and said, you know, every time I see your pieces, my first reaction is I just want to scoop them up and cuddle them.
Aww.
And then I look into their eyes and I find them enormously disturbing and I want to put them right back down again.
That's great.
And I thought, you know what? That's the best. That's the, because I always try for that dichotomy of we're all kind of on the edge between emotions that are kind of positive but also dark. And so for this person to verbalize it like that, I was like, okay, you just hit it for me. And that's the highest compliment I've ever received.
Brian, besides the 9-year-old kid, any memorable reactions?
I like to eavesdrop on people looking at
oh, yeah.
all art, mine included. I remember once I was doing a summer stint at the herb farm in its first incarnation as I was painting there, kind of as entertainment for them or for their guests. And I had some things for sale. Someone bought one of them, and my parents happened to be visiting at that time, and my mom followed them around. And so she came back and said, "What is this really about?" Because I don't know what their story was, but she wasn't getting it at all. So I like Jim said, I think it's just nice to have a reaction. So and generally it's positive. So
yeah, anybody ever gotten a really negative reaction?
Oh boy. Oh yeah. Yeah, I've been denounced for being psychotic and negative and creepy and just horrifying and, you know,
fun.
Which I can't deny are aspects of my work, but I don't think it's the whole show, you know. I mean, those things are in there for a reason.
Well, yeah, probably because we all have them.
Yeah.
And when you as an artist, any of you point that out to those who consume your art, I'm guessing they might react.
That's like, fair.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk. We're talking about, this is Real Talk, by the way. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. I'm talking with four outstanding artists who are distinguished artists on Vashon Island. And the question really is, how do you manage to distinguish yourself? Each of you has been talking about your distinctive styles. What were your first experiences as trying to be professional artists, trying to make a living? Who wants to jump on that one? Morgan?
My first experiences, I think there's always been for me, initially when I came out there, like I had mentioned before, there was a fear of showing a vulnerability and showing the emotions that I thought were just like totally bare naked out there through my work. So I think the first experiences of actually getting into a gallery, you know, and taking my work around to people, and it's kind of opened the door, so I realized that it wasn't just me having a lot of these vulnerable experiences, that so many other people got it, and that I wasn't alone with my own stuff. And that was a huge breakthrough. So I think that initial just putting up shows and being out there was just, first of all, getting over, you know, myself, mm-hmm. and moving forward. So
it takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, I think that's what I had to learn, is that it's all okay. Yeah.
So where was your first show?
My first show was at more of a crafts gallery, and it was in Fremont in Seattle.
Oh. Huh. Yeah.
And the place was called Frank and Dunya Gallery, and at the time, I was doing mask work and not the whole figure. So, but they were, yeah, very welcoming and people.
What were those made from, the masks?
They were made from papier-mâché, and I formed them over plasticine clay that I then pulled out after the fact, so they were just the shell, and then handmade papers.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I started putting bamboo around the outside, kind of stringing that, or not bamboo, willow willow branches. The bamboo were structural for the willow to stand on. And then I started cutting out metal figures and hanging those on there, kind of like Inuit masks around the outside. And then from there, I got hooked on the metal, on and on and on and on.
Wow, quite an evolution.
Yeah.
To where you are now.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Very different.
Brian, what was your first experience as a professional artist?
Well, I remember the first Strecker Gallery in Manhattan, Kansas was the first time I had a show that I felt like was a show, and it was a solo show. It was a very learning experience because I was living in Texas at the time. I had connections to that part of the world because I went to school at Kansas State University. And Julie Strecker offered me this opportunity, but it was at that time I was painting really big oil paintings, and I learned quickly if you're going to show someplace other than local, you probably should scale down. I think the biggest piece was 6 by 7.5 feet, so it meant like renting, you know, a truck to get it there.
Yeah,
I think Jim could speak to that. He had some huge pieces in this show that he just had at VCA. So that's the first one that I remember. Yeah.
Were you doing something else to make a living at the time?
I barely, yeah. I was, I've always done two other things in addition to my artwork, which is architectural design, particularly interior things, and interior illustration. So, well, not just interior, but architectural illustration. So at that time, I was trying to set that business up too, and paint too. I've always, the art thing is kind of, I'm a one-trick pony. I have to be drawing or painting or something all the time. That's really what entertains me. So I've always done it. So,
and does one medium feed the other for you?
It definitely does. Even at that time, at one point I hired a bunch of employees so that I wouldn't have to be doing that. I thought that was going to be my ticket out so I'd have more time to make art. Of course, that's ridiculous. You'd have to manage people. but I did learn all these things from them that I still employ in my artwork today, you know, how to, I don't know, layer things. And watercolor was a media that I got really comfortable with. And I kind of distanced myself from that because it was that world that I was always painting it for. So it became less attractive as a art thing for me. So, yeah.
Painting it for. I want to come back to that question because that's an important one. Jim, what was your first experience as a professional artist?
Well, I didn't really set out to be an artist. I set out to gratify myself by making the kinds of pictures I wanted to make. And as I said, it took me a long time to learn how to do that. But when I did, when I made the first picture that did it for me when I was 27 or 28, it put me in a state of ecstasy just looking at it. It was like I had made my own personalized metaphysical pornography, and it just completely sent me. I mean, I could look at my own work endlessly, you know, because it did exactly what I wanted it to do.
I'm going to use that term, metaphysical pornography.
Personalized. That's important. You have to have that subjective aspect.
So did you sell that to somebody or?
Eventually, yeah. I started making pictures and I started selling them just to people who saw them and wanted them. And I didn't go to art school or anything. I just barely finished high school, and I didn't really know how to be an artist or what to do. I just wanted to make these pictures. And then I put out a magazine, self-published magazine called Jim, which had my artwork in it and writing in it by me. And there, it got attention, and I got that. I had the opportunity to turn that into a published magazine by a Seattle publisher. And I only had gallery shows incidentally to doing this work. Occasionally a gallery would approach me and say, "We like your work. Do you have originals? Can we show them?" And I would say yes. So I never really worked the gallery scene. I just had these shows that were incidental to what I did, because mostly what I do is for print.
Yes. Yes, you are a distinguished, distinctive artist. Pam.
I feel like I'm learning so much, you guys.
Good. Me too.
Let's see. Well, before I studied with Ron Lucas, my teacher, I had a few shows. Here on the island, I had one. I showed with Ilsa Rimnitz. The very first show I ever had was with her. I was doing these huge, or not 7 foot, but pretty big, bigger than life portraits of street people downtown in Seattle. And she was doing fish, prints of fish and watercolors. Yeah. And we just looked at each other and went, why are we showing together? I don't know. Anyway, it was fun. And somebody from there on Vashon taught at Seattle U. So they arranged for a gallery showing of my work there. But then I studied for a few years, quite a few years. And then because I wanted to learn more. And the first time I kind of went, oh my God, I guess I'm an artist, was I would enter shows. First, I was just happy to get in the shows. And then I started winning a few prizes. And I won this prize where I went to the show. It was like third place in American Women Artists or something. And so I was on the way to the airport, and my husband at the time said, wow, you're doing this. You know, you won a prize and you're going off to Scottsdale. And that's when I got in my first gallery, was in Scottsdale, Arizona. So
high end.
Yeah.
High end stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to get back to that question of creating for, because Jim, you touched on it. You said you started drawing things that you just wanted to draw and you fell in love with what you were creating. What about the rest of you? Are you, and this could be something that's evolutionary as well. When you started, did you start painting, working your art, thinking you were going to sell it to others, or did you start making your art for you? Where did it come from? Who are you doing it for, Brian?
I've always truly what I consider my art, done it for myself. And I hope there's an audience that is, you know, in some way identifies with it. Like the big painting that I just mentioned, it was called The Pull of the Earth, and it's a large. I know what it looks like because a man about 2 years ago sent me a text and the image of he has that painting now, and he was anyway asking about it. But it's a big naked tree lady, you know, standing in front of these Greek ruins, and a man. Tree man coming down the steps in the background, and it was about relationship. I don't know, that was what it was about to me. But yeah, why I thought I'm quite certain I didn't think anybody else would be interested in it. I just wanted to paint it, so yeah.
Morgan?
Well, I think because I come from commercial art, graphic design as a background, I always thought that I'd be selling the work. And then it was a matter of finding myself in the work and doing it for myself. And I think as long as I focus on doing it for myself, then I'm okay. Everything's flowing and good. But there's been times of panic. Since I support myself all with the artwork and nothing else, there's times when the work hasn't sold and, I go into a full panic. And then I start thinking in terms of, well, how, you know, what's going to sell? How do I need to shift things? And man, that always gets me in trouble. I mean, it may work a little bit initially, but then I get so unhappy and bored and all the rest I always have to swing around and come back to, wait a minute, how do I make this work be me? Or more me than I've ever done before. Because that's the magic pill for making me happy and making the work ultimately sell again. You know, it's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah, it is. And it takes a lot of courage to get through those panic moments. Pam, who are you painting for?
Yeah, I think I can agree with all of you guys, actually. I mean, I think I do it for myself. I choose the subjects for myself. And there are times, like Morgan, you were talking about, that where I'm not doing it for myself. It's a commission painting. And those are my hardest ones to do because they're not coming from my heart necessarily. And I have to trick myself kind of into trying to forget that it's for somebody else, which is really hard. It never completely works. But, you know, for instance, I never take money up front. I just say to the person, hey, I'll paint it. If you don't like it, I'll put it in a gallery or something like that, so that I don't have to think about, am I pleasing somebody else? Mm. And one last thing is, when I'm painting a portrait show and it's not commissions, I feel freer. But at the same time, there's a little hint of me that's like, that doesn't quite look like that person. I better push it a little farther, you know. And so it's kind of a balance in there.
So that person you're painting is kind of creeping into the back of your mind and saying, no, I don't look like that.
It never looks like they think they look. But anyway, there's something in there that's a little, and maybe that's why I do it, because it's a little challenging. It's a little more of a challenge. I think portraits are the most challenging thing I paint. Those are the ones I kind of look sometimes on, maybe once a year if I'm lucky, and go, how did that get on there? That looks pretty good. Did you do that? You know?
That's a really interesting question to me. How do you know when you've done something really good?
I don't know. It seems like the thing that does sell first is something that I, you know, it's like, okay,
yes.
that happens.
Yes.
And frequently, things that don't sell, that's kind of what I will actually, that's more of a gauge. It's like, why? This is like my favorite piece.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Morgan, how do you know when you've done something really good? When you're by yourself in your studio?
Yeah, for me, I am always after that duality of emotion, that there is two sides to a person. And if I can, it's a really super hard line for me to walk, because it's so subtle. It's so hard to do. But every now and again, one of them pops out and I go, okay, well, you know, whoa, you caught it. And then it's just pure excitement. It's like, wow, I wish you could do that more often. But, you know, but I'll take it when it pops out. But I also totally identify with what you're saying, Brian, about that has nothing to do with the way my work may be perceived. My particular pieces are perceived out in the public. I mean, a lot of times ones that I really think are losers and someone will gleefully buy it. And I think, oh man, okay, good. Get it out of here.
Pam, how do you know when you've done something really wonderful?
I don't. And just like Brian was saying, it's always the ones, almost always the ones that I almost didn't put in the show that gets the most attention. But I think maybe because it's different than the others, you know, the ones that I kind of thought were pretty good. But it's very rare that I feel great about a painting in my studio. Later, sometimes I can look later and say, oh, okay, that one worked okay.
I know I've observed you in shows when people come up and compliment you. And I think what you've learned over time is to just say thank you.
Yeah. Just say thank you.
I thought that was crap.
Yeah, right. No, I try not to say anything.
Jim, how do you know when you've done something wonderful?
Well, I work hard at getting the effect I want. And I do many of the pages that I do more than once in pursuit of that. And when I've got it, I've got it. And I let it go at that. I don't worry about whether it's good or not. I just, if it rings the bell for me, it's done. And that's what I go for.
And you trust your audience?
I don't think about my audience. I just think about getting it done to my own specifications and according to my own lights. And I can relate to what Pam was saying. I handle commissions in exactly the same way. I don't want money up front, and I want to say, I'll do this drawing, which will resemble what you want, and then you can buy it if you want, because I hate the idea of delivering a piece of work to somebody and seeing disappointment on their face. It's the worst. So I avoid that at all costs.
Avoid disappointment.
Yes.
So all of you are making your soul livings on your artwork. One of the things that struck me, Morgan, as you were talking about when you look at the piece and you decide it's really wonderful, does that affect how you price it? Or how do you price your pieces?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I typically price by, because I started out as a graphic designer, I've always kept track of my time that I spend on pieces. And it gives me an idea of the ballpark of what I'm going to charge for something. But more and more, I just kind of look at a piece and go, oh, I mean, I've been doing it for so long. It's kind of like, okay, this is going to be this price. But no, whether I think it's the best piece I've ever done before or not, I don't think someone else is going to perceive it in the same way. And so it needs to fit in size relationship and detail to the others and be, you know, priced accordingly.
How do the rest of you price your work? I know, Jim, it's going to be different. You're publishing your work.
Well, I'm not sure that makes it different. I still am trying to get as much as I possibly can for pictures. And sometimes I can sell them for a lot and sometimes not. It comes and goes in waves. I'm not good at pricing my work. It tends to be somewhat arbitrary. Hmm. I tend to charge more for the ones that I think are good, even if it doesn't look like a lot of work went into them. And I think that makes it difficult for people to suss out what it is I'm basing these prices on.
Well, yeah, I suspect that's true for any visual artist. Pam, how do you price your work?
So I just price it by size because some of my best paintings happened really quickly. If I did it by time that I put in there, it wouldn't work. And some of my, you know... Anyway, sometimes they take a long time, months, and sometimes they take just a few hours or one day. So I can't do it by time, but so I just do it by size. And my prices got set up by those galleries I was in, so I haven't really changed them in like more than a decade. I just keep them there. I paint a lot. It's plenty. So
yes,
it works
do.
Out.
Yeah, you do. Brian, how do you price your work?
Well, the prices now reflect what the gallery actually. I've shown with Roby King on Bainbridge Island for a long time, and they were very good about encouraging me to raise prices. And so that's pretty much now where I actually still give them things and say, you price this. But that's kind of how it's come to be. But I can tell, you know, what's sold in the past, and size is certainly part of it. And for me, I do on some things keep a time sheet too. When I'm painting, I do that because my painting method is so laborious. I'm doing it mostly for my husband Peter, so he can say, "What are you thinking?" Anyway, so that comes into it too. That enters into it too. It's like if it takes me 3 weeks to do something, then that should probably be reflected in the price. So
many different factors.
Yeah.
And yes, you are all successful artists making your livings. How do you market your work, and who helps you get it out there and get it done, and get it sold? Who wants to? Pam?
I wish I did more marketing online, you know, like social media. So that helps a little bit, especially on Vashon. It's I need to do more Instagram, but seems like Facebook works. Galleries have helped all along. I'm not great at it. I think most artists think that they're not great at it. Somehow it keeps working. I'd say who helps me are more people that help me with hanging the show. Sarah Alexander often just gives up whatever she's doing that day and comes and helps. Her mother, Leslie Oldham, used to help me. And I have somebody who helps me make frames because I make them myself. And then my husband, Michael Monteleone, helps me title things. And he's a word guy and he just does a marvelous job, gives a whole nother level to the painting. But as far as getting it out there, I feel like every time I talk about this, I want to knock on wood because it just feels like I've been lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who helps you, Jim?
Well, my wife helps me. We have a website that she maintains, and I have a section on the website where I have one-of-a-kind pieces of art, and I also sell prints. And I also have a mailing list that people sign up for, and then I will send out an email saying, in lieu of having a Kickstarter or other fundraising program, I'm selling small works on paper in order to raise money and they're going to be on the website at thus and such a time, and those have always done well for me.
Anybody have an agent? Do you have an agent?
No.
Anybody?
No.
None of you has an agent. That Pam?
Well, I started with an agent. A couple people have tried to be an agent, but it turned out that the galleries, which is the direction I was going, they don't like to deal with an agent. They want to deal directly with the artist.
Oh. Has that been true for the rest of you?
The times when I have had galleries, I've just let them do all the PR. I mean, they want to do the PR, and every now and again I might add postcard or something like that, but other than that, they want to handle it.
Do you sell your work in any other way, Morgan, beyond galleries?
Well, actually, recently I've been more or less pulling out of galleries because it turns out I can do sales direct off of the social media, and if I work it, I mean, I get lazy, and you know, so I go through periods of really making it work, and then I get lazy and it backs off and I have to start over again. But I just found that some of the PR that the galleries were doing weren't quite up to snuff. I mean, I could do more and get more connections from the social media I was doing. So it's kind of all shifting and changing, and I'm just sort of an independent. I don't want to be told what to do. So I have to struggle with that. That's just who I am.
Well, it sounds like it's working for you, too. Brian, what sort of marketing venues do you use?
I usually look at what Morgan's doing and emulate her. She actually has very high standards, as she said, and her graphic background. The cards you've put together through the years, always amazing. She's always experimenting. She's like one of the first people I knew that really jump onto Instagram. I think you're the person that told me I should do it, actually.
Probably.
I haven't had a lot of sales through social media, but I have had a few. So, and it's always gratifying to have those and have that, you know, positive feedback. I like showing in a gallery, and I try to be in shows, regional shows, every year, a few, because it makes me reach, it makes me think, it makes me think differently. And I have deadlines. I'm still a deadline-driven person. I like to have a deadline so I can pull my hair out, I guess. So,
Well, you know, that's good information also for other artists who might be just getting started to know that, yeah, giving yourself a deadline makes you be more productive. And I wonder often about the skills that it takes to market anything and the skills that it takes to be the kinds of artists that you are. Are they different? And if so, how do you blend those? Hmm. Pam, you're nodding.
Well, I just know that I grew up in a family that or my mom's side of her family, everybody has their own business. So there's kind of a different kind of thinking of business thinking. And so friends of mine and other relatives have pointed out that I have a little bit of a sense of that. It's just innate kind of, but it definitely is the different side than does the painting. The painting side is more curious and wants to learn more and all that. And then the other side has to work too.
It's a little more driven.
Yeah, maybe in a certain way. Yeah.
What about the rest of you? Morgan, I see you nodding.
Yeah, I agree just 100% with that, that it's a different side of me that has to do the marketing. But then there's been this interesting thing with Instagram especially that has arisen. And I've noticed lately that the posts that can be the best are ones that talk about emotion and talk about vulnerability and all of that same stuff that actually is powerful on the art side. And so it's almost like all of a sudden you have to bring that into the marketing, and that's very, very effective because people then can relate immediately to what you've written, and then they get sucked in from there, hopefully. So, so it's always been two separate pieces of parts of me for years and years and years, but now lately it's like, oh, man, there's overlap here, and I have to pay attention to that.
That's fascinating. Pam, you had something to add to that.
I'm just curious, Morgan. Sometimes I feel like I'm using the art side. You know what I mean? Like the art side of me as if it was a child or something. And the other side that's selling is making the child do this stuff. And I just wondered if you ever feel that way.
Like you're exploiting your child?
Yeah, I'm exploiting this art side. Do you ever feel that?
No. Absolutely.
Oh, good.
No, I've done a number of pieces about the creative child. The creative child as, you know, it gets exploited. However, that creative child will lash back out at you if not fed properly. So, there's a balance that's needed.
That is fascinating. Jim, how do you blend the marketing side and the creative side?
Oh, well, my work, I consider it to be very, very serious, but it doesn't look serious. It's cartooning, it's fanciful drawings, it doesn't look like it's meant to be taken as high art, and that allows me to play around with it. So when I had my magazine, Jim, I had a mail order component in the back where people could write to me and get these things that I would make, like Bloody Frog soap. Which is homemade soap poured in a frog mold filled with iron oxide. So when you use it in the shower, it's like having a nosebleed. Blood run all over everywhere. It's a worthwhile product. And things like that. So I can be kind of self-satirizing and not take myself too seriously. My artist statement for the VCA show was, look what I made. And I can get away with that because my work doesn't seem like it's supposed to be taken seriously. And my point is what I want to do is get people to look at it and think about it. And if they think it's going to be a lark, I want to encourage that feeling up front.
So you're getting people to play with your child.
Well, you could put it that way. Yeah, I like that. That's nice.
Brian, how do you blend the two?
I didn't really speak to the commission thing. I resist that too, although I see there is a necessity to be available to do that. And then the marketing part of it is just kind of something that you have to do. And so I do it. I don't really, I'm challenged by it because I get bored with that part of it. I know that I need to have a sales site that I purchased the site for in 2020. Going into COVID, and it's still sitting there. I haven't done anything with it. So that's how I do it. I also make things that are out of my print process. I mentioned earlier that a lot of my imagery it gets discovered there, and then I turn it into other things. So and so those would be like garden art, metal garden art. And I Bob Powell on the island has an incredible capability to do things in metal, and increasingly more. He's great. It's what an absolute gem. And so he helps me do some of that, and that gives me something that I can sell, mostly during studio tour, at a price point that people can afford. So there's that kind of marketing, I guess, or thinking about product a little bit more.
So adding some diversity to
diversity. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what we're all. What excites us too is the learning, it's the curiosity about process and then media that we already think we know, and finding out more about it. Since I've known Morgan, I have seen her like morph several times through different media. Like when you were doing resin casting, when I think first met you, and then you finally said, "This is enough of this deadly stuff."
Yeah, it's really deadly. Yeah.
Oh dear.
Not good.
Oh, that's another whole topic. Yeah. We're quickly running out of time. I wanted to ask each of you, particularly since you brought it up, Brian, working with Bob Powell, how is it you interact with the rest of the artist community on Vashon Island? Or do you? How do you participate in the Vashon arts community?
I don't.
That was Jim, ladies and gentlemen.
I think many people don't. There are a whole community of artists that are in their studio, and that's where they stay, and their market or their audience is not the island. So I know both Morgan and Pam through many years of showing at the same time during studio tours and promoting each other.
Working on committees.
That's how I've actually connected, probably first through Barn Works when I first moved to the island, to other artists. That was a community of artists. And then through the years, being part of local shows. And then through Quartermaster Press, which is the co-op I mentioned earlier. And there are usually 8 to 10 artists there, and they have come and gone. So out there are many that have left the island and new people that are learning all the time and just sharing. So sharing what you do.
Well, there is the twice annual studio tour that is sponsored by Vashon Island Visual Artists, sometimes called Viva. And I think you're all part of that. Are you as well? Except
no,
Jim.
No, never.
Jim the standout. Yes.
True artist.
No, I just don't have a nice enough house to invite people over to.
So we are about out of time. So in the last minute that we have, I want you each to think about what you would say to a younger person, a newer artist who's trying to get started as a professional artist. What advice would you give? Who wants to go first, Pam?
I just say, don't wait till you're good, because you never feel like you're good enough. So put your stuff out there and let it speak for itself.
Nice. I like that. Who wants to go next?
I would say this is not a part-time job. I mean, even though I've said that I've always done other things, I've done it like it was, a challenge. And the challenge is to learn and get it out there. So just as you said, it's start now.
Yeah. I would say to get on social media and start showing your process and letting people inside just your own process. And that's what everyone wants to know about is, you know, your journey. And so talk about it.
Yeah, that's kind of revolutionary or revelatory, I guess, that everyone does really want to know about your journey. Jim, what would you say?
Well, I would say be true to yourself and don't listen too much to what other people have to say about your chances or what's out there in the world or anything else. Just make it about you and your vision and your discipline.
Good way to close the show. I cannot thank all of you enough. This has been a real joy. Folks, you've been listening to Real Talk. This is our first Real Talk special of 2023 with four outstanding and distinguished artists on this island, Jim Woodring, Pam Ingalls, Morgan Brigg, and Brian Fisher. Thank you for listening, and thank you all for being here. Happy New Year.
Thanks. Happy New Year, Susan.